And welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities.
Well, we remember what everyone else has forgotten.
As always, it is Nick Cameron, also of the podcast Galatian Musical Podcast, and I'm joined by my good friend, a Leedsian Yorkshireman of the Shire, Duncan Evans. How are we doing today?
Shire. Yeah, I'm doing all right. Thank you very much. Yeah, I've got my mint tea here. Yeah, all good. How about yourself?
I'm doing good. We have had a busy day already. My family and I have already been to the Art Museum to see a special exhibit on Henri Matisse. We have gone out for lunch at Red Robin. I want to thank our server for smelling delightfully like pot the entire time, which seems a bit much at 11:30, but, you know, I'm not going to judge. I'm not going to judge, except for the fact that I don't want to smell it. You know, smoke it all you want, but please take a shower, people. And then I have already started my dinner for this evening, because once I get off this call, once we finish recording this podcast, it is not going to go up as it normally does, because I then have an American football game to watch and then a European football game to watch. Two of my the St. Louis Battlehawks play, and then after that, St. Louis City Soccer Club plays. So I've got a day.
Nice. Got a day. Sounds cool. Sounds cool.
But nobody cares about that. That is not what we're here to talk about. What are we talking about today, Duncan?
This is a thing, an album, a record, a debut album from a band called Beautiful Creatures.
So are they, in fact, beautiful?
I don't know. I guess beauty's in the eye of the beholder, Nick. So, you know, you can judge, I can judge. We can all have our input on that. But I don't know.
That's a fair answer. I would say they are not beautiful, but that's just Nick talking. We're Beautiful Creatures is an offshoot of the nearly world-famous band Bang Tango, which friend of the show Danny Nichols has actually opened for. And previous podcast subject, Rowan... Oh, God, what is his last name? I fumbled this last time. I'm going to fumble it this time. On lockup... Lock Up the Wolves, the guitar player from that album, is now in the current Bang Tango.
I see, I see.
Rowan Robertson.
There we go. But yeah, so these guys formed in 1999.
Hang on. I got one more big link to this one.
Come on.
This is not only linked to Bang Tango, as the lead singer Joe Lateste. It was the lead singer of both bands, but DJ Ashba is the guitar player in this band, and DJ Ashba later goes on to play in the Heroin Diaries with Nikki Sixx, which we should do on this show at some point. And after that, he goes on to perform with Guns N' Roses. I do not believe he ever recorded with Guns N' Roses, but he was on stage in the last edition of the pre-reunion Guns N' Roses.
Absolutely. It's Joe Lestay, not Joe Lateste. Joe Lestay of Bang Tango, the singer.
Hang on, that doesn't sound right.
Joe Lestay. Joe Lestay.
Okay, you know what? It might not sound right, but it totally is right. I got that wrong. Totally, yes, Joe Lestay.
Absolutely.
Along with Kyle Kyle.
Kyle. Is Kyle Kyle in the band? Oh, in Bang
in
Tango.
In current Bang Tango, yes. Yes. Right. Yes. Sorry, right. I'm off track. I will shut up and let you go.
No, it's all right. So these guys formed in 1999. So basically, what happened? I don't know. You tell us what happened, Nick. How did they form?
Well, Bang Tango is a band that formed in the late 80s in Los Angeles, California. Some people call them of the Sunset Strip. Some people call them of glam metal. I watched a documentary on them recently, and they described themselves as nothing and everything all at once, and these wonderful, huge, grandiose ideas. And then they played their music, and I did not hear any of those grandiose ideas. But I felt like they were glam metal, kind of in the vein of Guns N' Roses. A little sleazier, yeah. A little dirtier, a little bluesier, but would not be out of place on a tour with Poison, Warrant, or Skid Row. Although Skid Row isn't exactly those guys either, so, especially since they're from New Jersey mostly. But they were an interesting band. They had one really good album that their fans still love to this day, for nearly 40 years later. Then they did a second album. They brought back their same producer, who then told them, "You guys, you're not ready to record this record," at which point they fired him, because they were ready to, in their minds, they were ready to record. Then they found out when that album tanked that he was completely right. Then after that, they write and record another record, and they bring back their original producer. However, they record it, they finish it, they're very proud of it. It is, oh, what is the name of that one? It's got a weird, Love After Death. And that one comes out, would have come out during the height of the grunge era. It would have come out even before Kurt Cobain had died by suicide. I mean, that deep into the grunge era.
Yeah, we're
And
talking 1993 here.
yeah, and then the record label said, you know what? You guys recorded it. Yeah, we're really proud of you. But not only are we not going to release Love After Death, but we're going to drop you from the label. So
Exactly.
they
So it
were.
got a release eventually, but only in the UK and Japan through Music for Nations a bit later on.
Yeah, Music for Nations is an it's a European label that every release of theirs I'm aware of has been an American band's release in Europe. So
Sounds about right.
they did two or three Metallica releases in Europe. I know they did Creeping Death, the maxi single, which also featured the original Garage Days Revisited, which was just two songs, Am I Evil and Blitzkrieg. They also released Metallica's Jump in the Fire over there, I
Just looking
believe.
at this, they're not, it's not only American bands, there's loads of British bands and European bands, Opeth, Anathema, all sorts of other bands. So it's not only
Okay,
American
fair enough.
nations, but
Well,
yeah.
that's good. I would much rather be a band. I would much rather be a label that has their own bands rather than a label that just releases American stuff. But so yeah, Love After Death gets a release on Music for Nations on a. I wouldn't say I'd call it a niche label, if not necessarily a tiny label. I would say it's
Yeah.
pretty well respected in European metal circles and known of in American metal circles, which. Considering they don't release anything over here, that's pretty significant, I would say.
Indeed.
And then at this point, after Love After Death is pulled and the band is dropped, this is when Bang Tango starts parting out members. And, quickly, they have as many member changes as Yes does in the 1980s, or Kansas in the 1980s. In fact,
Well,
I.
yeah, they kind of split up, didn't they? So they split up in 1995 after returning from a European tour, the Love After Death tour,
Correct,
and then
correct.
they kind of reformed in 1996 with what's described as a revolving door of musicians, apart from Joe Lestay and Kyle on bass, who stayed permanently in the band around this time.
Correct. And they have done some albums. There have
Yeah.
been Bang Tango albums with the modern day band. And there even was a reunion with the original lineup back in 1919. They were going to tour in 2020.
Yes, but I think essentially they broke up at this point. They broke up around 1999, as far as I can see. So they did this revolving door lineup thing, and then I think they sort of dissipated around 1999. And
No,
then,
they're still going.
but then how come there's reformation in 2002?
Oh, yeah, they broke up in 90. Okay, so they. Yeah, because they broke up in 99, because that's when Beautiful Creatures happens.
Exactly, that's what I mean. Yeah,
Okay,
exactly.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
So it sort of dissipated again at that time. Then Beautiful Creatures happened. And then, yeah, Bang Tango have they reunited with the original lineup in 2019 to 2021, but had another previous reformation around 2002. So actually, they've actually been together most of the time. They've just split up for a couple of years at a
Right.
time, about twice.
It's more appropriate to say something called Bang Tango has existed for most of that time.
Indeed, indeed. I think
Because,
always with Joe Lestay.
yeah, Joe Lestay is the one constant. And I would actually make the point that I don't think anything happened with the reunion lineup, because they announced in 2019 that they were reuniting with the original lineup along with Kyle. And it's
Yeah,
it,
but did they actually do anything? Because it would have been locked
r
down, wouldn't it?
correct. Would have been locked down, so nobody was touring in 2020.
Indeed,
In fact,
indeed.
I didn't see until after the pandemic was over. I think 21, not well, not over, but I think 2021 was the first show I saw again. Might have even been 22 now that I think about it. I don't remember for sure,
Yeah.
but the last show I had seen before the pandemic was November of 19, John 5, which an amazing show, by the way. If you get the chance to see him. You, Duncan, you won't like it because it's going to be all unnecessary twiddle. So there's going to be no necessary.
Unnecessary twiddles, yeah. Only necessary twiddles allowed for me.
There will be no necessary twiddles in your brain if you go to that show.
Okay, all right.
Anywho, so they do their it comes and it goes. And during the second breakup, which happened in 98, that's when There were a couple of acts or a couple of projects that Joe Lestay started. The first one had a single out, and that's really all it had. So that's why we're not talking about it. And I don't even remember the name of it. I watched a documentary on Bang Tango about a week and a half ago, and that's actually what brought this particular episode on. And then in 1998 is when Beautiful Creatures or 99, I believe, is when Beautiful Creatures actually forms.
That's right. That's
And
right.
that's and originally he was going to bring back one of the guitar players that came in, the first replacement member of Bang Tango. He was going to bring him in, and the guy was a big Kiss fan. And the guy's like, I know I don't want to do it. I did that, and it's kind of I'm kind of done with that right now. So what ends up happening is Beautiful Creatures gets a spot opening up for Kiss in Texas, I believe it was, when Ted Nugent had to pull out of the show. So immediately, Joe
This is when there
Lestay.
was, yeah, sorry, and this is when they were still called Hellstar.
So Joe Lestay calls the other guitar player, and he goes, "Oh yeah, I know you love Kiss, so I just thought you'd want to know this. Beautiful Creatures, the band I asked you to play guitar in, we're opening for Kiss. Have a great weekend. Talk to you soon." Click.
Indeed,
And then they
indeed.
ended up, and they only opened up for Kiss for about three shows. Unfortunately, I would say that that opening up for Kiss slot was not enough to push them over the edge, as this is a forgotten album.
Indeed, it is, yes.
So there's a lot of little and intertwining history throughout all of this, but as a band, there's really not a whole lot of history. They form, they record, they do a tour. I think, let me rephrase, I think they did a tour.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not entirely certain, but I think so.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Formation debut album. Hellstar, yeah, Hellstar was their original name. They had a top 40 hit on the Billboard Top Heat Seekers album.
Yeah, that's Wasted. Yeah, number 37. Oh no, hang on. That's the album. That's the album, number 29 on the Billboard Top Heat Seekers, whereas the single Wasted peaked at number 37 on the mainstream rock tracks and not the actual main
Oh
chart.
yeah. So the album peaks at 38 on Billboard Heat Seekers, and Wasted peaks at 37 on the mainstream rock chart. So that's neither of those are insignificant milestones, I think, for a band who at the time the kind of music they're playing, that they're the kind of music that the principals in the band would be known for is completely verboten. We are still a couple years out from the glam metal revival. Probably about 3 or 4 years out from the glam metal revival. So, but it's we should point out that neither of those charts are the Billboard chart. That
No,
is
they're not.
neither the Billboard 200 single nor the Billboard 200 album. Those are specialized charts underneath that only do a subset of all the music rather than the main charts that do everything. But
Exactly.
I would say that they had some pretty good steam going. So what happened?
Well, yeah, but they got dropped from the label, didn't they? After not too long. So by the end of 2001, the album had sold 25,500 copies. But when Time Warner and AOL merged, they were dropped with sh after shake up to the record label. And it says here abysmal record sales. So there you go. So it just did not sell anywhere near what the label wanted them to sell. So 25,000 copies was just not what the label wanted. I guess they wanted hundreds of thousands. Or whatever.
Well, when you're on a major label in the late 90s,
I guess
yeah.
that is abysmal. So there we go. But the album got rated in Metal Hammer in the UK as number 11 the top albums of 2001, which is quite an accolade to achieve. And there seem to be some mixed reviews, mostly fairly favorable, but definitely a little bit mixed. There's a few caveats on those reviews where they say, look, it's great, but. Just to explain what caveat is to anyone who doesn't know what caveat is, there you go.
Oh, we've got very smart listeners, Duncan. I'm sure all of our listener knows that word.
Indeed. But so that's kind of it, I think. Well, actually, no, there's one other little point, which is that there's a A&R guy who's called Jeff Blue, who it seems like he basically co-wrote half the album. He's on seven of the tracks, what, six of the tracks as writer, co-writing with Ashburton Lestay, which is just an unusual thing. So I don't know how that exactly happened, but he is a producer. He did not produce this album, but he did A&R for the band, or A&R on this record, whatever that exactly means. I'm not sure how A&R for a record quite works, but there you go. That's what he's credited as. And he co-wrote half the album. So there you go.
I wonder how much money he made from co-writing several of the songs, getting publishing on several of the songs off this record. Probably not a whole hell of a lot. But let me dial back a little bit. When you had mentioned when Time Warner and AOL merge is when they get the axe. At that time, when that merger happened in America, that was a huge deal. I mean, big, big deal. And there were a lot of artists on a lot of the Time Warner labels that just got the old heave ho. And I would say, based on, I mean, if I'm running the label, regardless of whether or not I like an al like the album, with as much press as they got, with the charting, the nice little charts they got, I probably would have given them one more to see what happens. But nope, they're dropped. So end of 2001, they are dropped. The album sold basically nothing. In this era, if you're on a major label, basically if you don't sell 200 to 300,000 copies, that's pretty much going to be the end of you every given time. And then they're going to send you a bill for how much you spent to record the record. Record, press, and promote. Not that anybody ever pays those bills, I don't think. And then in the beginning of 2002, February 13th, it is announced that DJ Ashba has left the group. And Ashba released a statement, left on good terms, received the new edition with open arms, blah, blah, blah. And then a month later, guitarist Michael Thomas left to join as a replacement of Ashba. However, then Thomas leaves the band. And in April 2000, he leaves the band to tour with Suki Jones, which was the first incarnation of Adler's Appetite.
Oh, yes, I remember that. Yeah.
A friend of the show, Danny Nichols, saw Adler's Appetite and told a wonderful story that he regretted to a minister that I know, which I still make fun of him for, because that was such a funny, funny story, which we're not going to tell on the podcast because it's not appropriate.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. But yeah, so that happened. And then they did manage to actually record a second album, didn't they? Which is called Juice. So it finally was released on April the 21st, 2005. But only in Japan, I think. Oh no, eventually released in August 2005 in the US, ha having signed with Spitfire Records.
Spitfire
So.
Records was the one of the labels that former podcast subject Union was on, and the drummer they brought in for this album was Matt Starr, who for a time was the drummer for previous podcast subject Ace Frehley on the Anomaly and Space Invader tours. So when I saw him, that Matt Starr was drumming for Ace.
Yeah,
Quite a good
but
drummer and a good singer too.
sure. But they were still having a lot of issues with lineup changes, many, many different members coming and going. And they did embark on a UK headlining tour with Stephen Pearcy of Rat in 2006. But they were announcing a new album in 2007, but I'm not sure whether that ever actually came out. I don't think it did.
It is not listed in the discography. In the discography, they
No.
list two records, Beautiful Creatures and Deuce.
So I think it never came out. So there we go.
I
Shall we
mean,
get into
anybody
the
can
album?
announce it. Anybody can announce an
I
album.
can, indeed.
Before we get into the track by track, I just want to make one small point. In both Bangtango and Beautiful Creatures, the leader of both of them is the same person, right? And both of those bands end up having a problem holding on to members.
Yep.
Maybe, I wonder who the problem on that one was.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, man.
You know what? It is what it is. And a lot of bands are very volatile. I think we know this. And some of the most volatile bands are the most beautiful and wonderful, like the aforementioned Guns N' Roses. I'm going to mention my daughter now because she tells me I have to mention her in every episode and that she's very cool and has wonderful musical taste. Don't worry, Dad. It's not a lie, is what she tells me. But she tells me yesterday, she finally admits to me, you know what, Dad? I think I'm starting to like Guns N' Roses.
Right, wow, okay.
Apparently, her friend has convinced her to listen to Guns N' Roses. So, I mean, I couldn't, and her mom couldn't. We tried, and I'm pulling out vinyl records. I'm like, I got this. We could listen. She's like, no, I don't want to. And it turns out her favorite Guns N' Roses track is my favorite Guns N' Roses track, which is Mr. Brownstone. And I'm like, we could have been rocking to this song for 2 years by now, but nope, you wouldn't listen to Nick. What does Nick know? But that is another example, I think, of a band who was horribly volatile, but their volatility just worked perfectly.
It did, yeah, you're right. Certainly for a period of time, at least.
Now we're gonna stay up late, and we may go. We're gonna figure this out. Even we're gonna figure out if this kind of band, if this band's volatility works the same, even if we have to stay up to 1 a.m.
1 a.m., track one. So this starts with an effecty riff, and it kicks in, and there's a little bit of punk. There's a sleaziness to this. Pretty fast riffery. The vocals are brash and growly, a little bit Axl Rose, a little bit Bon Scott, and it's nice, groovy, sleazy rock and roll. The chorus is catchy, it's well written, it's tuneful, it's melodic. And you know what? Yes, it's a rerun of Guns N' Roses and Motley Crue, but it's pretty good as a version of that. There's a breakdown with clean guitars, and there's a big guitar solo that does the usual thing that you'd expect, but it's pretty good. So it's all stuff that's been done a zillion times before. There's nothing particularly new here, but they're doing it well. It's punchy, it's straight to the point, it's don't bore us, get to the chorus stuff here. So I thought this was a great opener.
Completely agree. I mean, this one, it is a great opener, and it is a really good song. It is dated. I mean, it's very dated. It's got that effectiness that, I mean, I don't know that you can describe it other than that late 90s sound where everything sounded wrong, but it worked. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know how to describe that sound. That it's like the 80s wet drum. We had this 90s weird distorty thing. I don't know. But yes, this is definitely Guns N' Crew or Motley Roses. And what's ironic is the lead guitar player from this band, the guy writing all the music, ends up joining what could have amounted to Motley Crue and what did amount to Guns N' Roses. So they definitely picked the right person. And when those guys needed somebody, this is a good song, a good opener. I don't know if I should say this, but I will. This is the best song on the album.
Okay.
And they were smart enough to put it where they did, so the track wasn't wasted.
Track two, Wasted. So this starts with an anthemic riff and it's steady to fast. And then this is where it all goes pretty wrong pretty quickly for me. It kicks in and it's gone all Limp Bizkit styly. So this is quasi rap rock, and I'm just going, no. Rap rock is something which can work in very few limited circumstances, but generally, just to me, is awful and horrendous and unforgivable. This is not good. It feels like he's trying to be Fred Durst. It's very dated. It feels like they're capitulating to the contemporary heavy rock, heavy metal of the time, late 90s, early 2000s, and it just doesn't work. The chorus is all right in a melodic punk rock sort of Wild Hearts kind of way, but it's so cheesy, the rap bits and the verse. The solo is exactly what you'd expect. And you know what? Yeah, there's loads of chorus towards the end, and the chorus is catchy. It's pretty good, but the rap rock element ruins this one for me.
Yeah, I think probably the word of the day to describe this record is going to be dated. Everything sounds so much of the time that it was recorded. So I guess at the time it comes out, this thing is ultra modern because it actually comes out a little bit ahead of the curve on all this.
It's dated in two ways. It's half of it's 1987 and the other half is 2002. And it's like sorry, not 2002, 1999, really. So it's 1987 or it's 1999. And it's like, which one are they leaning into more heavily at the time? And yeah.
And they never really lean into both of them at the same time. They
I know
lean
what you mean.
in, they go back and forth. So, like, they're leaning on one wall, and then they get off and they go to the other one. I think if they had found a way to combine those two things at one time, this would have made for a much more interesting album. But How you combine those two things, I considering they're largely just two very competing ideas. I don't know what they sh you know they should have thought about it for a second before they got going. They should have taken a step back.
All right, that's track three, Step Back. So this starts with a clean but very effective intro, like whoa, 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 whoa. Anyway, so then it kicks in with this steady, fast thing with a syncopated big rock riff. And the vocals are more snarly here. And this is not bad at all. It's definitely a step up from the previous track from Wasted, but there's nothing new or original here. And this is where the cheese factor kicks in a bit more because they're leaning a bit more back into 1987. But it's a cheesy version of that, and it can that 1987 Sunset Strip sound. It is kind of cheesy, and a few bands managed to really transcend that. Guns N' Roses being one of them, but the bands that were beneath that were cheesy, generally speaking. Even Guns N' Roses are pretty cheesy. They just kind of transcend it by magic somehow. Like you don't mind that they're cheesy, basically.
They're cheesy in the way that's great. They're cheesy like
Yeah.
Parmesan on your spaghetti.
There you go. But then the trouble is, they go for the chorus back into a bit of rap rock where they're shouting, step back, and it all feels like Fred Durst again. And it's no good. It's either trite because it's just been overdone so many times since 1987, or it's cheesy because of the 1987 factor or the 1999 factor, or it's just pandering to the perceived in sound of contemporary rock at that time. There's a solo, a guitar solo with some interesting weird dive bomb things, which I kind of liked. But this is damning with faint praise. This is just not good, really, for me.
Yeah, I don't take notes anymore because I don't need to. Because you just say everything that needs to be said. If you are the best person I have ever heard in my life at describing the way a song goes, and you just nail it. Unfortunately, a lot of times you leave nothing left for me to say.
Sorry, Nick.
It's all right. That's all right. Nobody wants to hear me talk. But yeah, step back, man. That's got shades of Break stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know which one came first. Actually, no, I do know which one came first. $3 Bill, y'all, was first.
That was first, yeah,
Because I
Defo.
saw them. I bought that album. I'll admit it, I bought it. I bought it. I'm sorry, I bought it. They were playing on Ozfest, so I figured I'd listen to it. And the CD actually wasn't bad. It wasn't spectacular. It wasn't awful. The problem was is when I saw them live, how terrible they were live, and I just got rid of it the next day. But yeah, we and that kind of music is kind of a slightly on the way out at this point. I know I said it was right on top, but now that I'm doing the numbers and the math, because Korn was like 95.
90. Yeah, I guess it started around then. Yeah.
And
So
then
the
by like
big.
96 or 7, they're huge.
Yeah.
And not
But
that
I
Korn
still
is.
think, I don't know, man. I think in 2000, 2001, the new metal thing was still pretty massive.
But it was different.
Maybe.
Yes, nu metal definitely still existed, but I think it's probably more. We probably need a different name for it because Slipknot was very different from Korn, very different from. God, who's the Blood, Sweat, and Tears?
Don't know, man. Not sure what you're thinking.
Oh, I know who. Oh, God, it's driving me crazy.
Mudvayne.
No. And here's album. Machine Head.
Oh,
Machine Head.
Machine Head. Yeah.
So I don't know whom I've seen twice. I saw them at Pops once. But it what they are doing is the Limp Bizkit-y style of nu metal.
Yes.
And Limp Bizkit on their next record kind of goes away from it.
Yeah.
On the Limp Bizkit's next record, they have a lot more like straight up rap songs.
Yeah.
Which are undeniably terrible, but it is what it is. If you're going to go out and you're going to try to make a record, you're going to have to take a ride.
All right, well, that's track four, Ride. So this starts with a grooving fast riff and then it kicks in with a nice syncopated rock and roll fast-ish thing. And it's not bad. The chorus is not bad. The verse is not bad. The solo's not bad. In fact, the solo's quite cool because it goes into this weird noise rock Tom Morello style thing, which is actually the highlight of this track and probably one of the highlights of the album, actually. But this track was just okay in every way, and I didn't have much to say about it because it was just so okay and just such a vanilla. It was a slice of tasteless vanilla.
Do not insult vanilla. Vanilla is the finest of the flavors. I'm going to quote Bare Naked Ladies. You know, whenever I get my coffee, French vanilla. When I go get a milkshake, French vanilla. Do not insult vanilla in my presence, sir.
Yeah, I mean, I have no problem with vanilla, but I'm just using it as a placeholder for insipid. Let's go with insipid.
Yeah, that's way better. This song is very insipid. It's the okayest song on the record. You know what? It might actually be really, really good, but it's bookended by a couple of songs that are not really, really good. In fact, I would say Step Back is pretty abjectly terrible. And now I'm gonna move on into Wish. And if I could make a wish, my wish would be that this song was not on the album.
All right, well, what did I say about Wish track five? Well, starts with, yes, this is, oh yes, I remember this one. It starts with clean guitar, ballady stuff. Then the vocals come in and it's like, no. It's that overly emoting nonsense cheese where they're pretending to be sad and everything's so serious, and it's awful.
And then they're singing about things that have the emotional weight of losing a shoelace.
There you go, losing a shoelace. Yeah, I like it. And it kicks in after a while with this big rock ballad, super cheese style, and I'm just not buying it. There's no conviction here. I'm not convinced by this at all. And there's a fine line, you know, there's November Rain, which again, it is cheesy, but it somehow sits above cheese. It's like you say, it's the good cheese. It's the cheese that you want.
November Rain is a wonderful brie spread onto artisanal crackers.
There you go, exactly.
Wish, however, is fondue in the 70s made from American cheese.
Yeah, exactly. And we're trying to pass that off as the really good blue cheese stuff, and it's not working at all. So, no, there's a fine line. This is on the wrong side of it. There's a guitar solo that does exactly what you'd expect, nothing more, nothing less. And the chorus, yeah, it's big and it's catchy, but it is just cheese. And sure, I can see why people would like it. Maybe people that have bought the compilation CDs or have the compilation playlists, you know, top rock ballads or whatever, that really love their rock ballads. Yeah, maybe they would like this. But no, for me, being not a fan in general of big rock ballads, this is just down there in the cheese pit, I'm afraid. Not good.
I love big rock ballads. November Rain is a masterpiece. I said what I said. Every rose has its thorn. We'll always get people flicking their lighters in the air, even after everybody has quit smoking in the world. This, however, is abject crap. They're trying to get that emotional roller coaster that the aforementioned songs I just named can get you to. But as you said, it is completely unbelievable, wholly cheesy, and yeah, they're trying to give you slices of Kraft singles, and they're trying to call it, blue cheese or camembert, and it's just not. Yes, I do use Monty Python's The Cheese Shop to pull out names of cheeses for when we make this analogy.
Nice.
But next track is Kick Out. I don't know. I can't make a good pun for that, so I'm not even gonna try.
All right. Well, maybe they could kick out some of the tracks that are less good on this album. There you go. I did it
Well,
for you.
they definitely could.
Or they could kick out the jams. So does this one kick out the jams?
Can
It
they, though?
does. Actually, yes, with this track, they really do. This has a groovy syncopated riff and it kicks in quite fast. AC/DC vocals, very Bon Scott. And you know what? This is the best since 1 AM. And it's definitely about as good as 1 AM, maybe even slightly better. Great chorus, back in their best territory, bluesy hard rock. We're in 1987 and we're just doing it really well with a bit of a nod back to the 70s as well. They're not trying to be 2001, they're not trying to be 1999. They're just there in the 80s with a bit of a more modern production. And it's great. It works well. Catchy chorus, strong verse, bluesy growls, great riffs, does exactly what you need it to do. It's nothing new, but it's great for it. Solo, guitar solo with a key change in there. just steps it up a gear. Same old stuff. You've heard it a million times before, but they're doing it well. It does work. So this is a breath of fresh air, this one, and they do kick out the jams with Kick Out, in my view.
Well, they kick out the singular jam anyway.
Singular jam.
That's my little joke. Yeah, not a bad track. You know, this probably would lead off side two if this was ever released on vinyl or cassette, and I don't believe it was, just due to the time frame that it came out. I don't know. Anyway, not a bad song. Much better than, you know, what preceded it. However, if you've got a blacklist, I want to be on it, to quote Boots Riley.
All right, Blacklist track seven. This is acoustic finger picking, folky bluesy stuff, or it starts with that. Then it kicks in with a telephone voice and bass and drums, but it's still mellow and mid-paced. It gets a bit heavier and goes a bit post-grunge as it moves forward. And then it finally kicks in heavy for the chorus, and it's got this "We are, we are, we are, we are the Blacklist" riff, and it's okay, but it's cheesy. And then we're back to mellow for the next verse. And then we've got a key change, and it goes double time for this mid-late solo slash coda with a variation of the chorus. So is this good? It's okay. It's okay. It's cheesy. It's not horrific, but it's not up there with the best on this album, and certainly not up there with the best that there is on the planet. So yeah, it's okay.
I'm sorry, I can't get past the cheese factor of this song.
Okay.
You know, we have a group of five straight white males talking about being blacklisted. That being a straight white male in America is the most privileged thing you can be. I know, I am one. And yeah, so they're like, "Oh, we're on the blacklist." What blacklist are you on? Are you a communist now and you didn't tell anybody? I mean, come on, guys. This is just stupid. Don't be stupid. If you're gonna try to make people feel ways about things, at least, you know, this just reminds me of Stand, right? How many times have we talked about Stand by Poison as the absolute example of what everything wrong with most of these records that we deal with is?
Yeah.
That is the ultimate personification of what's wrong with many of these albums, where you've got these guys that don't have any belief structure. I mean, can you tell me that Bret Michaels believes firmly about anything in this world, that he really feels any ways about anybody that's not himself? I don't
Yeah.
think so. And Joe Lestay, being as he can't keep a lineup of a band together for more than 8 weeks, probably doesn't care much about other people either. So he probably doesn't feel that many ways about things either. So basically, what we have here is Stand. Here are our beliefs. They are no. And we're blacklisted. Are you, though? You're blacklisted for what? That thing we believe. You know, I mean, that's just, you know, basically, he's just saying stand up for what you believe. The only thing missing is the gospel choir. And being as it starts off as a ballad, you might as well have just brought in the gospel choir. There was probably one recording in that studio that day already, anyway.
There you go.
I mean, it is the late 90s. There's probably one hanging around somewhere already in their robes. But you know what? That song, they didn't kick out the jams, and that song is not kicking for days.
Track eight, kicking for days. So this starts with toms and a groovy riff, mid-paced to fast. And it kicks in with a sleazy Guns N' Roses-esque riff with lots of whack-a-chaka guitars. The vocals are very AC/DC again. It's not bad, and the chorus is nicely catchy. My problem with this is that it's so Guns N' Roses. They're doing that kind of down, no. Bit like Welcome to the Jungle, but it's just not anywhere near as good as Guns N' Roses. It doesn't have that bite. It doesn't have quite that sleaziness somehow. So I'm comparing it to that, and it just pales in comparison. There's a breakdown to a mellow section for a bluesy solo, and it's all fine, but it's just what you'd expect and nothing more. The solo carries on for it to kick back into the chorus chords. And you know what? It's not bad bluesy hard rock stuff, the solo. Then we've got some more chorus. And you know what? It's all just fine. It's one of the better tracks on the album, but it's not blowing my mind at all. It's just all right, pretty good. It's fine.
Yeah, and this is the second most okayest song on the record.
Yeah.
It's not bad. Now, this is the kind of stuff they should be doing, because when they're trying to like sing about things and stuff and It's I was watching The Mighty Boosh the other day, right? And it's the episode where Vince becomes a punk, and Howard's like, "What are you angry now?" "Yeah, about what?" "Stuff." "What stuff?" "Punk stuff." "Like what?" "The government, climate change, I don't know, fashion." And that's how these, I mean, half of these songs are them trying to like be Vince Noir in that moment. Well, I mean, not trying to be, they are Vince Noir in that moment. Like, oh, we feel, yeah, strongly about something, and you should too. But when they do Kickin' for Days, which is a song about goddamn nothing, it's fun. Because you're not smart enough to sing about things that people care about or that you care about. Let's just be realistic about things. You know what? It's fine. AC/DC's not smart enough to sing about things either, and they made a great career out of what they did. I got like 20 AC/DC records, and I'll keep buying more. Know what you can do well, and if you enjoy it, do it. Sometimes it's just important to stay in your lane, boys. Just stay in your lane. Your lane is not wild philosophical songs. You are not the Doors. You will never be the Doors. And I have to say that on this show, time and time again.
Well done, time and time again, track nine. So this begins with piano and acoustic guitar, slowish strumming. And then he's doing that overly emoting vocal again, the ballad vocal. So I'm not enjoying this at all. And it's pretty cheesy, post-grunge-ish rock balladeering with one foot in the 80s and one foot in the early 90s this time. And it's 2001. So this is all a hodgepodge of strangeness here. The middle eight gets even more cheesy, and then there's an acoustic guitar solo, also cheesy. It's just a cheese fest, and I'm not enjoying it at all.
Yeah, that's kind of the problem. When it gets really cheesy, it gets really stupid. And I don't enjoy the really cheesy stuff. And they're not staying in their lane. And you know what? That's just the best advice I can give you. Stay in, you guys need to stay in your lane. If you do that, you're going to write some fun songs that we're all enjoying. Instead, you have us all going off about how we don't like them.
Going off is track 10. So this begins with a Tom Morello style effecty riff, and then it kicks in with a mid to fast groovy syncopated thing. And then the problem is, oh no, it's the rap metal thing rearing its ugly head again. And this time it's kind of like Bon Scott rapping, and it's weird. And
Who
it's
asked for
cheap.
that? Who asked
Exactly.
for Bon Scott style vocals rapping?
Yeah, nobody. And then they've got this pre-chorus that goes, hey, whoa, yeah, if I could only find a way to make you understand. And it's just cheesetastic. And the chorus is also cheesetastic. There's a solo with some twiddles and some bluesy wah stuff, which is fine. It's one of the better elements of this track. But no, the rap metal thing ruins it, and the rest of it's just okay. So I'm not buying this one at all.
I mean, rap metal, when it's done right, it's kind of like glam metal, right? I mean, how much have we talked about glam and hair bands where, like, Poison? I love Poison. I really do. And I mean, I know I use them as a whipping post a lot because they've done a lot of things to whip about. They've been around for 35 years and they've only done three albums that are worth listening to. What does that say? That does not, I mean, that doesn't speak well for you. And when hair metal is done right, the cheesiness, you just want to, I mean, you just want to lick the cheese. You're just like, yeah, give me that. Give me that. It's great. But when it's wrong, it's like, ew, this is just terrible. And rap rock is got an even finer line than that. The first couple Faith No More records where they leaned into rap rock a little bit were amazing. You've got Propane, a band out of New York who was amazing. You have Biohazard who did it wonderful. Then you've got there's the Judgment Night soundtrack Keefe and I talked about on the Glacier Musical Podcast a couple weeks ago. That is all rap rock and all brand new songs, but it's not a one artist doing rap rock. It's a rap artist and a rock artist working together writing songs, and those are amazing. However, 99 times out of 100, when a band that is a singular band does a rap rock song, it's crap. Because you got to be able to do both. And when they do, their rapping business is terrible. And when they do that, it makes the song suffer. So again, stay in your lane. Do what you do, Do it well, do it great. This isn't it. And you got a pun for the next one?
No.
I don't either. So the next song is called New Orleans, not the train.
Yeah, okay. So this starts with a major key power chord fast thing, and it goes mellow for the verse, and it's a bit of a feel good down homey Lynyrd Skynyrd sort of southern rock vibe going on here, but this is so cheesy. And the chorus is catchy, but it's in a horrible, very poppy sort of way. And I'm just not enjoying it. And I guess I was finding it difficult to find many notes to write about these songs because it was all starting to just get to me a bit. It was all too much of the same old cheesiness. So there's a guitar solo that does exactly what you'd expect, but no, too much cheese, not buying it, unconvincing nonsense, not for me, no.
Unconvincing nonsense. I think that's something we have to say. Because
Yeah.
yes, that is now a term. Because this song, every time they try to like sing these emotionally charged songs, whether they're ballads, whether they're this kind of thing, yeah, it's unconvincing nonsense. It doesn't work, and I'm embarrassed for you. I am embarrassed for this band when I hear these songs. When they play like 1 a.m. and kick out and kicking for days, I don't feel embarrassed at all. I love that. But then you're like, oh, I got such a big heart and it's bleeding about the starving children in Bulgaria or something, or wherever children are starving. It's like in A Christmas Story when the mom says, eat that, children are starving in Japan. When she meant China, but or Africa. And that's how that is how oh what's the word legitimate the way they feel about things are is it sounds that illegitimate.
Yeah.
And after all this, I got it all.
Well, this is the final track, track 12. I got it all. So this is a good one. It has a stomping kick drum and a syncopated riff, and then it kicks in, and we're back in AC/DC territory again. And this is what they should be doing. This is much better. This is the second or third best track on the album. It has a really nice chorus where they just do sort of barking the title with some question and answer, some answer phrases in between. I got it all, da 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 da, whatever. And it works great. It has a nice bluesy solo that again does exactly what you'd expect, but it does it well. So it's fine. This is a great track. This is what they should have been doing all along. Three tracks out of 12, a quarter of the album, is really quite good. This being one of those. There we are. That's all I have to say about this one.
I think you just summed up the entire album. One quarter of this album is amazing. And three quarters of this album are them trying to be something better than what they're good at.
Yes.
Tom Hanks in the late 80s, he tells the movie industry, I can do drama. And nobody believed him. But then he did drama and he was amazing. And now he does drama. Jim Carrey, same thing in the late 90s. Like, look, I want to do more serious things. And he does them and he's taken seriously now. It doesn't work for everybody. And you're trying to write these serious songs that just come off as laughable.
Yeah.
It's your serious songs are so laughable and so terrible. We've coined a phrase to describe this. Well, Dust or Duncan coined the phrase, excuse me, but I'm putting it into the Department of Middle Antiquities lexicon. That's going to go up there with stand, which we all know what stand is, right? And that's when you got that gospel choir out. So unconvincing nonsense. You have so much unconvincing nonsense. You have so much stuff that sounded dated 3 weeks after it was released. And then you've got these things that are really good. Unfortunately, the things that are really good is what you did the least. But I would also probably point out that if they did an entire record of the AC/DC, Guns N' Roses, Motley Crue stuff, it probably wouldn't have been taken seriously either.
Maybe not, maybe not, but that's still what it should have done.
Although this was when Motley Crue gets back together. Motley
Yeah.
Crue is had reunited about a year before this is released. No, Generation Swine, previous podcast subject, Generation Swine was released a year before this album. And Anybody who ever heard that record knows that this record sounds just like that record. Where half the time they're doing the, you know, the AC/DC Motley Crue stuff, and then the rest of the time they're trying to sound modern and edgy. It just, I mean, does it ever really work when a band tries to sound modern and edgy? Does it ever work?
No, it doesn't.
So what's the lesson from today's podcast, I think? What do you
think? Stay in your lane.
Stay in your lane. That is my sum up. What you got, Duncan?
Yeah, pretty much the same. I'm not going to talk for as much because you've summed it up right there. They didn't stay in their lane. They stayed in their lane for a quarter of the album. It's not enough. The rest is cheesy nonsense for one reason or another, whether they're trying to rap too much or whether they're just doing the cheesy 80s ballad thing kind of badly. So that's it. It's a bin it from me. You didn't say whether it was a spin it or bin it from you, so I'm sure we're all on tenterhooks wondering what you're going to say, Nick. But yeah,
yes, I'm sure I wasn't clear enough in my takedown of the record. This is definitely a bin it for me. I will never listen to this again. This is... The songs that are great, but they're not enough. It's not enough. Like one of the, you know, Keefe and I discussed, you know, one of the 30-30-30 album is like one of my favorite things that I've created. And Keefe would say that Van Halen's Fair Warning is a 30-30-30 album, even though only one song is good. But okay. That one song is so good that it makes up for the rest of the badness. That song is Unchained, by the way, which is Van Halen's best song. I actually just got that album in the mail the other day. I haven't listened to it yet. But the songs on this album that are so good are not good enough. And this actually might even be a 30-30-30 record, except that it's probably more like 30-10-80 or 30-10-60. 60, yeah. You know. And the highs are just not high enough to bring me back.
Yeah.
If you had done something spectacular, something new, maybe it would be enough to make me buy the album, to make me want to listen to this again. But no, you were carbon copy. Your carbon copy was fun, but you didn't carbon copy enough. So bin it for me, I'm afraid. And that is all I have for the week. Do you got anything else?
No, that's it. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Everybody, thank you for listening. If you've made it this far, if you could please give us a review or subscribe on whatever podcast service you listen to, and then please get at us on Twitter, Blue Sky, Threads, whatever, Instagram. You can catch me at Glacier Musical or NIK_NO_C, Nick No C on Twitter. Duncan, you can catch at D Evans Music, basically everywhere, because he was smart enough to use one thing.
I'm actually Duncan Evans Music on Instagram and Facebook, but I'm D Evans Music on Twitter. So
close enough. If you Google Duncan Evans, you'll probably find him. If you Google Glacially Musical, you'll probably find me. If you could get with us, and what I would love to know is, what podcast service do you listen to stream this? Interact with us. Anyway, this has been the Department of Metal Antiquities. We listened so you don't have to.